WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Soviet Union may be dead, but the post-mortem examination isn't finished yet. My guest Adam Ulam has written a new book called The Communists, The Story of Power and Lost Illusions, 1948 to 1991. Ulam directs the Russian Research Center at Harvard, where he's also a professor of history and political science. Communism, he says, was initially sustained by the idea of social justice and a new international order that would end imperialism and war. But the dream of world revolution gave way to a very prosaic notion of communism as an instrument of power and control. Stalin and Mao used their power to create the cult of the leader. Ulam says even from communism's earliest days, it depended on the notion that the Soviet leadership was infallible.
Power was within a narrow group of oligarchs at the top, sort of the equivalent of the Politburo, some 10, 15, 20 people. And eventually, by the end of the 1920s, the next logical step came, namely the dictatorship of one man and the kind of dictatorship which Stalin practiced, which I don't think can be compared to anything in modern times. Even Hitler's powers at the height of the Third Reich look sort of puny compared with what Stalin did. Once Stalin was not around, it became obvious that the traits of communism were so clearly imprinted in the body of communism that to try to erase them, to excise them from it, would lead to the fall of the system. That was why, when Mr. Khrushchev tried a very modest reform, he was kicked out in 1964. And then when Gorbachev began a much more serious reform, 86, 87, it became very obvious that as one of the communist leader said, we didn't realize that you cannot reform unreformable. And that was the Communist Party and the communist system.
Do you think of Stalin as being the last leader in the cult of the leader in the Soviet Union?
Yes, they've had now enough of the cult of the leader. And of course, this opposition to the cult of the leader, in a sense, led to the rejection of authority in general. What we have seen since Mr. Gorbachev began his ill-fated reforms was that a little bit of freedom stole into the system, and then it became obvious you couldn't carry on the system at all.
Do you think that after Stalin in the Soviet Union and after Mao in China, that the leadership really became more of a bureaucracy than the cult of the leader? Yeah.
What used to be first sort of despotism turned into sort of oligarchical bureaucratic system. And really the Brezhnev years in roughly 64 to 82 or 85, if you prefer, in Russia were sort of the golden age of the bureaucracy. You had those bureaucrats sitting at their desk until they collapsed. When Mr. Gorbachev came to power, the Minister of Nuclear Energy, a very important job, was 88 years old. The prime minister was a man, I believe, who was 80. In other words, it was a government of septuagenarians and octogenarians, as the Chinese government to a large extent is today. But more than that, there was sort of an unwritten compact between the top leaders, some 15 or 20 members of the Politburo, and sort of vast serried ranks of the oligarchy, bureaucracy. The top people ruled, and the bureaucracy had sort of job security, unless they did something extra swinish or tried to undo the leadership of the top 15 people. They could sit and drowse at their desks until they fell dead, practically.
You write that you think that the bankruptcy of communism took a long time to really show because of the significant achievements like Sputnik, because of the Soviet weapons development, and because the Soviet status as an imperialist power. So you think all of that basically covered up weaknesses within the Soviet Union that were there all along?
Very much so. I think that foreign policy of the Soviet Union, especially since World War II, was, you might say, a gigantic public relations campaign to cover up the faults of the system. Since the Soviet Union grabbed Eastern Europe, in effect, made it, those countries its vassals, the Soviet citizen was to feel very proud and to forget the fact that his standard of living was lower even than in those countries over which the Soviet Union ruled, like Poland, Hungary, and so on. He was to forget that he didn't have any liberties or freedoms about which he heard more and more about the West. So this whole foreign policy made sense only, expansionist policy, from the point of view of covering up the difficulties and the inherent faults of the system. And of course, that couldn't work very well either, because eventually a very pushful, expensive, aggressive foreign policy risked nuclear war. So I think that became obvious to the Soviet leaders, and finally to Gorbachev especially, that you cannot go on this way. You have to help this remedy the system internally and to abandon this belligerent position against the United States.
If you think that the Cold War kind of served the Soviets in distracting people from domestic problems in the Soviet Union, do you think that the Cold War served certain ulterior motives in the United States as well?
No, I don't think so. I think there have been groups in the United States, of course, which viewed this as a mission to sort of stop and destroy the evil empire, but the American people have never been imperialistic, and not even the most imperialistic-minded administration or president really could go very far in pushing the people toward imperialist expansionist policies. The best proof is after World War II, when the United States was superpower is not an expression, the only serious power in the world. When the Soviet Union had lost 27 million people in the war, we were hardly touched insofar as casualties were concerned compared with the Soviet Union. When we produced half of the industrial production of the world, when we had, of course, the monopoly of the nuclear weapons, and yet the United States the Soviet Union, in effect, annex East Europe and make all those nations, which broke out from under its rule in 1989, make all its nations its vassals. It was done very largely because the administration, and even a more alert administration to Soviet weaknesses, could not have really gotten the approval of the United States, people in the United States, for more hard-nosed foreign policy, even for banging the table and saying to the Russians, enough. I think the mood was, peace has come, let us enjoy it. And I think that was a very important element, has been an important element in our policy throughout the whole Cold War.
Many Americans are now questioning how our military spending might have hurt the American economy over the years. What about the effect of military spending on the Soviet economy?
Well, it had an absolutely ruinous effect on the Soviet economy. I am reminded of a Russian proverb, before a fat man gets thinner, the thin man may croak. And while it was very difficult for us and undoubtedly hurt us vis-a-vis, say, Japan, which has been spending, of course, very little, relatively speaking, on defense, the fact is that this tremendous effort put by the Soviet Union in its military establishment was one of the contributory factors to the increasing Soviet technological and economic backwardness in the 70s and 80s.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Adam Ulam, who's the director of the Russian Research Center at Harvard University, and he's also the author of the new book, The Communists. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Soviet expert Adam Ulam is my guest. He's the author of the new book, The Communists. After World War II, the Soviets took over the Eastern European countries. In retrospect, do you think that was a big mistake for the Soviet Union?
I think it was a huge mistake because you could rule them only with an iron fist. And very soon in Eastern Europe, you found proofs, even in Stalin's life, during Stalin's life, that the main thesis and the main attractive points, attraction points, so to speak, of communism, namely that was supranational and would bring an end to wars and things like that, that was completely wrong, that on the contrary, communist regimes were likely to be more hostile vis-a-vis each other than capitalist versus communist and so on. The best proof was the rebellion of Tito's Yugoslavia in 1948, when Tito, who was sort of, in a way, a miniature Stalin, decided that he didn't want to be bossed by the big Stalin. And that was, of course, one case which showed that internationalism, so-called proletarian internationalism, professed by communism, its promise of ending wars and international hostilities was very hollow. And a much more fundamental proof came with the split between China and the Soviet Union and the fact that those two countries, professing seemingly same ideology, found themselves, it's no exaggeration, in the 1960s and 70s on the brink of actual war.
Well, you know, communism was supposed to be this world movement, and you said that the differences between China and the Soviet Union had much less to do with ideology than just with different styles of power, and wanting to be the most powerful.
Well, I think that if you had sort of word association and said communism, the first word which would come to your mind is power. Communism is a seeker after power, not seeker after a juster society. And once you had a country like China with its huge population, which could not be treated like Poland or Bulgaria, and could not be, so to speak, blackmailed by Soviet military power, so the conflict was inevitable. I mean, Mao would not take orders from Stalin. Mao's successors would not take orders from Khrushchev. Khrushchev, in turn, didn't see much point in helping communist China if communist China was going to challenge him. At one point, the Chinese even claimed various territories, Soviet territories in Asia, the territories which had been conquered by the Russian Empire from the 17th century on until the end of the 19th century. So it became obvious that communism may spur national antagonisms rather than soften them. And I think that was one of the crucial elements in this complete disillusionment about communism as an ideology, which contributed to the loss of nerve or the loss of self-confidence on the part of that generation of communists to which Mr. Gorbachev belonged. They tried reforms, half-hearted reforms, but the main thing was that they lost the gift and this the ability of effective repression, and they tried to make revolutions by halves, and those who make revolutions by halves dig their own political graves.
My guest is Adam Ulam, the author of the new book, The Communists. Professor Ulam, I was wondering if you had any personal reasons that led you to become a Soviet expert?
No, I became very much interested in sort of English politics, and that was my original field of study. But then I was interested in socialism, and I from socialism to Marxism, of course, from Marxism to Marxist-Leninism in the Soviet Union. Sometimes I would put it jokingly to my colleagues and friends, when I said that I used to teach a course on the British Empire years and years ago at Harvard, then every year a piece of my course would fall out as the empire disintegrated. So I decided to shift to an expanding rather than a contracting subject, which at that time was the Soviet Union. But lo and behold, the Soviet Union has now itself followed the British Empire Act, and you have. But seriously, I think Soviet history, not only Soviet history, but Russian history in general, has interested me because it has so many interesting intellectual problems. I like mystery stories, and there are so many mysteries. about the Soviet past, and of course, even about the Soviet present.
So you made it sound as if you had to find a new area of specialization now, now that the Soviet Union has collapsed, yeah.
People implore me not to do anything about the American government after my dissolution of the two empires. But no, I'm still interested, and I think the subject of Russia and the other parts will in a way be more important now than it was before. I think before, despite the Soviet Union's challenging position vis-a-vis the United States, I think there was underneath realization, not expressed explicitly under Gorbachev, that a nuclear war, hence any real conflict between the two superpowers, would be suicidal for the world, for humanity. Nowadays, you have a situation where there's still lots of nuclear weapons sort of lying around, and the kind of central control, which was there until 88, 89, no longer exists. And it is a challenging thing to really to try to see what kind of solutions can be found for all those countries. So I think its subject is still of great importance, even though there's no such thing as the Soviet Union.
Well, Adam Ulam, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Adam Ulam is the director of the Russian Research Center at Harvard University and the author of the new book, The Communists.